If you have your Bibles, open them up to the book of Ruth. To the book of Ruth. If you go to your Old Testament, Joshua, Judges, Ruth. Well, while you're turning there, let me explain to Dr. Blazing why it is that I have my dogs in my bio. It's because we know all dogs go to heaven, and I'm not a universalist, and so that means we know where cats go, and so that would be why we don't include cats, and I'm just kidding. You all know that's not true. I will no longer be teaching systematic theology anywhere around here if I contend that. But you do know that Shadow is Nochi's daughter, and so there is some close relative there, and so we do have to include her into the bio. But if you will turn to the book of Ruth. The book of Ruth is an interesting book. Just imagine for a second the name of the book. It is named after Ruth the Moabite. It is one of two books named after women. If you were to look at the books named after women, you would have Esther. And in Esther, you find a Jewish woman who marries a Gentile king in order to save Israel. In the book of Ruth, you find a Jewish man who marries a Gentile woman in order to demonstrate the kinsman redeemer, our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. In the book of Ruth, you will find four chapters. These four chapters contain 85 verses, and it has somewhat of a chiastic structure to it. And so, since Dr. Patterson doesn't believe in chiastic structures, I asked Mrs. Patterson, and she provided it for me. And this is how it goes. In verses chapters 1 through 5, you see the family of Elimelech. And then in chapter 1, 6 through 22, you'll see the faithfulness of Ruth. That progresses then into two scenes where you see the kinsman redeemer and Ruth interacting. The first is in a barley field, the second in a threshing floor. And then you see the faithfulness of Boaz, and you conclude the book with the family of David. That is the structure that you will find here in the book of Ruth. The author of the book of Ruth, we do not know for sure. Some have suggested that Samuel would be the author, but it does indicate the time of David, and so that's unlikely. As far as the timing of when it was written, it tells us in the first verse. It says, in the days when the judges ruled. And so this book follows after the book of Judges. And we understand that the book is set in a time when the judges ruled. In order to understand what that time is like, all you would have to do is flip back one page to chapter 21, verse 25, and see that it says, "And in those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes." And so that is the setting for you of this great story in the book of Ruth. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes. Now this morning, what I'm going to try to do is read the first five verses to you, walk through the story, and then jump to the conclusion. And so I've titled this message, Three Funerals and a Wedding. We'll focus on the three funerals, we'll get to the wedding, and we will tell the story of redemption and romance in the book of Ruth. Let's read verses 1 through 5. It says, "In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. And a man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn in the country of Moab. And he and his wife and his two sons. And the name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife Naomi. And the name of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephratites from Bethlehem in Judah. And they went to the country of Moab and remained there. But Elimelech, the husband of Naomi, died, and she was left with her two sons. These took Moabite wives. The name of one was Orpah, and the name of the other Ruth. And they lived there about 10 years, and both Mahlon and Chilion died. So the woman was left without her two sons and her husband." In these first five verses, we see three funerals. In these first five verses, we contain a wealth of information. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine. I find it interesting that there was a famine in Bethlehem, and yet 50 miles away in Moab, things seemed to be okay. Perhaps that indicates that this famine in Bethlehem was God's judgment because they were living as though it were the time of the judges. They were doing what was right in their own eyes rather than living the way they should have. We see that a man who lived in Bethlehem, the house of bread or city of bread, went to sojourn in the country of Moab. We see that it was at first a sojourn. He didn't want to go for long. He just wanted to go for a short amount of time. But by the time you get down to verse 2, it says he remained there. And then by the time you move on down, it says they were there about 10 years. He didn't intend to go for 10 years. He intended to go for a sojourn, but what he finds out is that he remains much longer than what he intended to go. They went to the country of Moab. You all will know this. You all will remember that Moab was a country which actually started as the descendants of Lot, as Lot had an incestuous relationship with his oldest daughter. This is not a place that you would want to visit. This is not a place you would want to go. You will remember that Balak wanted to have a curse pronounced on them, and so he had Balaam and a donkey got in the way of that little incident. But then you'll remember Numbers chapter 25, it was the women, the Moabites, that caused the children of Israel to move into inappropriate relationships, and 24,000 people died. Moab is not a place where you want to go. It's not a place where you even want to visit. They served a god named Chemosh. And it is recorded that before this god named Chemosh, they had child sacrifices. They killed their children before this god. This is not a godly place. This is not a place that you want to go. You will notice also, if you were to look at Psalms chapter 60, verse 8, or 108, verse 9, that it is called God's washpot. And so you went from Bethlehem, the house of bread, to God's washpot. Nowhere in these verses do we find that Elimelech was called by God to be a missionary to these people. Nowhere do we find that he went to be an evangelist to these people. All we see is that there was a famine. And so we must assume that his motives for going to Moab were financial. It was because of the famine. He went to Moab in order to save his life and the life of his family because of the famine. And what we find happening is that he died and his two sons died. He did not adequately count the cost of traveling to Moab. We know that Moabites also could not enter the temple. Deuteronomy chapter 23 says they could not enter the temple up into the 10th generation. Nehemiah 13 repeats that, except it leaves out the 10th generation. And so some have even stated that the intention here was that no Moabite would ever enter the temple. And so these are not people you want to associate with. But for economic prosperity, he made a decision to go to a place where he should not have gone. Elimelech's name means "My God is King." The name of his wife there in verse 2 is Naomi, which means pleasant. And so we see a picture here of Naomi as a person who has a smile on her face, who greets everyone, a person that we want to be around, a person that we enjoy talking with. And the names of the two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. Now, these names may sound kind of cool. They may sound like something you would like to name your children, but I wouldn't recommend it. Mahlon means sickly and Chilion means dying. And so you can imagine here that when it came time for the dinner table, he would holler out and he would say, "Chilion, help sickly get to the table. Oh, I forgot, you're dying. Never mind." Who in the world would name their kids Chilion and Mahlon, sickly and dying? They were Ephratites from Bethlehem in Judah, and they went to the country of Moab and remained there. But then something happens. In verse 3, it tells us that Elimelech, the husband of Naomi, died. Tragedy is struck. She's heartbroken. But she has her two sons left. And these two sons took Moabite wives. Now, it is not expressly forbidden. Moabites are not expressly mentioned. But the two sons took wives who served the god of Chemosh. This is not a good thing. What you must understand and what we must take from this is Elimelech, as the leader of his house, as the spiritual leader and director of his household, made an economic decision that placed his sons in danger of marrying women who did not serve God. Our decisions that we make as the leaders of our household also have spiritual impact. Here, his two sons married Moabite wives. The name of one was Orpah. Might as well have been Oprah because she wasn't a believer after all, but it's Orpah, and so get the R in the right place. And the name of the other was Ruth. And they lived there for how many years? 10 years. They went for a sojourn and remained for 10 years. And both Mahlon and Chilion died. Naomi has gone to a place to flee for food so that death would not happen to the family, and she finds herself with 3 funerals and now 2 daughters-in-law. Throughout the rest of this passage in chapter 1, we will see that Ruth was faithful, and as you walk down through, you'll see in verse 6 that it says that they were in the fields and they heard that the Lord had visited the people and had given them food. Now here in this instance, you will see the use of the word Lord. The use of the word God or Lord is used 23 times in this book. 23 times in 85 verses, you'll see the instance of the use of the word Lord. Every time but 2, it's on the voice of the characters who are in the story. 2 times it's used by the person who wrote the book. It would be in this first instance that you will see here in chapter 1, verse 6. And then we'll see it again at the very end of the book where the Lord gives life. Our writer is setting the scene and he is putting parameters on it of how the Lord has now blessed Bethlehem. The Lord will bless again in the future. And so Naomi decides, I have nothing holding me here. Everyone's dead. I'm going to travel back to Bethlehem. She picks up and proceeds to go to Bethlehem, and her daughter-in-laws are going with her. She says to them, though, may the Lord deal kindly with you. Why don't you go back to your mother's house? We don't really want you to come with us. There's nothing for you in Bethlehem. She explains to him, I have no other sons. Even if I were to get married and conceive tonight, you're not going to wait for a son to grow up. You're not going to have any hope of being married if you go with me. There is nothing that I can offer you if you come with me to Bethlehem. They said to her, no, we're going to return to your people. She said, no, you can't do this. She says in verse 13 there, if you'll look, she says, no, my daughters, for it is exceedingly bitter to me for your sakes that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me. She recognizes the divine judgment of the actions that have been taken. The hand of the Lord has gone out against her. And so she urges them and says, no, you stay. The image we receive there in verse 14 is then that Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung. We have two differing images here. Orpah kissing and leaving. Ruth clinging. I wonder if Naomi ever reached up later on in her life and rubbed that cheek that Orpah had kissed and thought to herself, why was it that I told her to go back to Moab? Why was it that I encouraged Orpah to go back to her gods, to serve the God of Chemosh, rather than coming and serving the God of Israel? Ruth says no, and Ruth clings. And Naomi says, Ruth, look at what your sister-in-law has done. She has returned to her people and her gods. We call this here anti-evangelism. We don't like it. We don't teach it. We don't encourage you to do it. Why in the world would you ever say to somebody, no, you don't want to come with me. I'm going to church. Why don't you just go to the mosque down the street? Don't go with me. I'm going to church. You don't want to serve the God of Israel. You want to go serve Allah or someone else. This is not something that makes logical sense to us, does it? I do not know the motives of Naomi's heart, but it is possible that during this instance, Naomi was covering up, Orpah was giving up, and Ruth was standing up. Perhaps what Naomi had crossed her mind is, if I go back to Bethlehem and I'm carrying two Moabite women with me, they're going to know exactly what I have done. I've allowed my sons to marry Moabite women. If I get rid of these Moabite women, they don't go back with me, they won't know what happened. I can tell the story any way I want to. It can be a tragedy without everybody knowing the depths of the depravity. Maybe that is what's taking place in Naomi's mind. We do not know for sure. But we do see here that Orpah gave up. She went home. And we see that Ruth stood up. Verse 16, in a verse that's often used in weddings, you'll see it said, Ruth says, do not urge me to leave you or go, for where you go, I will go, and where you lodge, I will lodge, and your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried, and may the Lord do so and more also, if anything but death parts me from you. You see Ruth here making an astonishing commitment of covenant marriage that has happened to Mahlon, and even beyond that, even saying, you know, after you die, where you die, I will die. What an amazing commitment. And she says, your people, your God, my God. Ruth has chosen to abandon the God Chemosh and to serve the God of Israel and to take refuge there. In this first chapter and in these first five verses, you see what happens when you follow human wisdom, devastation and destruction. The rest of the book, we're going to see what happens when you follow divine wisdom and when you seek after the God of Israel. What happens? Well, they return back. Verse 19 says, the two of them went and they came back to Bethlehem. And when they came back, the whole town was stirred. I can see it now putting it in today's society. They come back to town and all of a sudden the bloggers go crazy. Blogs all over the place are talking about Naomi's back. Is this Naomi? Boy, she looks rough, doesn't she? Sin's really taking its toll. Naomi's back, and she's got a Moabite with her. Can you imagine what happened? Her husband's not there. Her sons are not there. Oh, boy, the Lord has judged her harshly. All over the blogs, you see it taking place. And here, Naomi answers and says to them and puts up on her Facebook status, change of status here, do not call me Naomi, call me Mara. Now, what? She says, don't call me pleasant anymore. Call me Mara, meaning bitter. I'm no longer pleasant, I'm bitter. She left a pleasant young woman, blessed and full, and came back a bitter old maid. That's what sin will do to you in your life. She says, the Almighty has dealt bitterly with me. I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty. I went away because of famine, but I was full and didn't realize it. I have come back empty, because the Lord has taken away my family from me. It's an application that can be made here to our own lives. If we're seeking after economic prosperity, if we're seeking after things that this world has to offer us, we may find ourselves leaving full only to come back empty. If you're seeking after the things that this world may tempt you with and entice you with, and you're not following after what God's calling is on your life, you may find out that you left full only to come back empty. She is now bitter. She says, "Call me Mara." She exaggerates the situation too. She says, "The Lord has brought me back empty." What about Ruth there in the background? What about the covenant that had been made? "Oh, but woe is me. Things are horrible, things are bad. I am back empty. Don't call me Naomi. The Lord has testified against me and brought calamity upon me." And so we see that Ruth and Naomi have returned to Bethlehem. In chapter 2, we get a new scene. This new scene is introduced with a little information that we need to know. Boaz comes on the scene, and the two things we find out about him immediately are that Boaz is a relative and Boaz is a worthy man. And then we have in chapter 2 a scene that takes place in the fields. This scene is set off with Ruth talking to Naomi, and it concludes with Ruth talking to Naomi. Chapter 3 is set off with Ruth talking to Naomi, and it concludes with Ruth talking to Naomi. Now, I'm not trying to say that women like to talk a lot or anything like that, but you see the scene here being set off with a lot of talk from the ladies and then a little bit of action squeezed in between. Here, what you have is Ruth saying to Naomi, "Let me go down to the food bank and get some food. Let me go down and glean the fields. Let me go out and walk behind those who are walking and to pick up what they leave. Let me get the corners of the fields and glean that in. Otherwise, we're going to starve. Let me go and do a little work." And so she says to her, "Yes, go and do a little work." Notice the word that's used here at verse 2. It says, "Let me go to a field in whose sight I shall find favor." Chapter 2, verse 2. You'll also notice in chapter 2, verse 10, that same word favor is used. It says, "Have I found favor in your eyes?" And in chapter 2, verse 13, you'll see a similar word favor there. "I have found favor in your eyes." That word favor is also the word for grace. They have come from Moab back to Bethlehem and found grace. Isn't that the story of all of our lives? Is that we have been in the city of Moab and we need to come back to Bethlehem and find grace. She comes back. She finds grace. She goes out. She's working in a field. And it says in verse 3, she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz. All right, how many of you say good luck? You don't have to raise your hands. How many of you say, "Oh, Lady Luck was on his side. Oh, he was a lucky individual." How many of you have ever used the word luck before? Well, here it says she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who's the person we just happened to be told about a few verses earlier. And not only that, but Boaz happens to come to that particular field on that particular day from Bethlehem and happens to take notice of Ruth, who happens to be in that field. Does this sound like happenstance to you? This sounds like God's divine providence acting and moving to me. If we were to look back over the pages of history, we would see the providential pen of God writing the very chapters of our lives. If we looked back over this institution, we would see God directing the steps to lead us to where we are now. In our local churches, God is in control and directing, and in our very lives, God is arranging the circumstances so that we understand He is in control. I could give you many examples, but I've only chosen one that I want to give you today. It's when I was a third-year student in college. You got to remember, I grew up a country boy, okay? Third-year student in college, I go into my advisor, and my advisor says, "You have to choose a major." Well, I'd already had five majors, and I didn't like any of them. I had changed out all five of them. I didn't have a clue what I was majoring in. So I looked at my advisor with great confidence, and I said, "Tell me what I ought to major in." He said, "You need to major in English." Well, I thought to myself immediately, well, he's recognized some great skill in my penmanship, and he thinks I have some great ability, and so this guy's recognized some talent that I didn't know I had. Sure, I'll take your advice. Sign me up. And so the next semester comes, and I go to an upper-level English class. I'll never forget this class. This class was titled Critical Theory Since Plato. I went to the class, country boy. I went to the class. There were eight people in the class. It was a small group. I had read the material. I sit down in the chair. I understand I'm probably not going to get away with this. And the teacher, sure enough, calls on me. "What did you think of the reading last night?" I'd said nothing in the class up until this point. I responded to the teacher and I said, "I think he done a good job." That was about the most intelligent statement I had in me at the current moment. For those of you that don't know, it's supposed to be "he did." And so the teacher immediately responded back with me in this upper-level English class and said, "You mean he did?" I said, "I'm glad you think so too." She looked at me and she said, "You mean also?" I said, what are you talking about? She said, don't end your sentences with a preposition. And some guy from the other end of the class said, oh, he's doing that on purpose. Nobody could be that stupid. Welcome to upper level English. I'm going to go back and see that advisor one day. I learned that day. I put on my best Vanilla Ice impression. I leaned back in that chair. You know, I crossed my arms. I folded. I took the gangster look, if you know what I'm trying. My best impression of it anyway. I can't do it real well. I tried to appear like I was that bad boy in class. After class, out of that classroom, immediately I went. And then later on, I went to the professor's office and said, I don't have a clue what just happened. For 2 years, that professor worked and taught me a little bit about correct pronunciation, correct grammar. She brought me a long way from where I was, we'll put it that way. Nobody in their right mind would have ever thought I would be teaching systematic theology at Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. Nobody. Now you tell me, was that advisor happenstance? Or did the Lord have other things in mind? I can tell you for sure, looking back over the course of my life, the Lord's hand has guided every step. It wasn't anything special in a country boy in South Carolina that brought him out here to Texas. It was the Lord guiding and the Lord directing and the Lord who deserves the glory and the honor and the credit for everything that has happened. And so even in your life, even right now where you're thinking to yourself, oh Lord, I have Dr. Lee for a professor. Oh Lord, my schedule this professor has Dr. Lee and Dr. Allen on it. Oh Lord, I've got Dr. Lee, Dr. Allen, and Dr. Williams. I don't know why you sign up for all of them at the same time. But if your semester is that bad, I mean that hard, that's what I meant to say, yeah, that hard. If your semester is going to be that tough with finals, the Lord's working in your life. The Lord has a purpose for it. He's refining you for it. He's using your time here to refine you and to guide you and to direct you for what He has in store for you down the road. Don't think any of this happened by happenstance. Ruth didn't happen to come into the field of Boaz. God had it planned all along. Boaz didn't happen to be a close relative. He didn't happen to be on the scene. We see this scene develop and we see it take place. Boaz comes along and he looks out here and he sees Ruth. And he says, well done, God. He looks at the guy beside him and he says, who is that? What's she doing in the field? Ruth's out there working. Ruth's out there being diligent. What does he find out about Ruth? He finds out about Ruth that she's a Moabite woman. Must be important information because all throughout the book they keep reminding us Ruth is the Moabite. Says also, she came and she said in verse 7 of chapter 2, please let me glean. She didn't take the law as something that could be hers by demand. She came to the field with humility and she said, please let me glean. And then she has continued working until the morning until now. And then Boaz says, you know, I like this person. And she went up to Ruth and he said, now listen, my daughter. Do not glean in another field. You stay in this field. I'm going to keep an eye on you. I have told my young men not to touch you. You drink what they have brought up from the well. You don't have to go down to the well to get it yourself. You just come up here and drink what they're drinking. And her response, Ruth's response, which you see there in verse 10, is she fell on her face, bowing to the ground, demonstrating humility, and saying, why have I found grace in your eyes? Why have you noticed me when I am someone who is not noticeable, when I am a foreigner? Why have you taken notice of me? And we find out that Boaz has been reading the blogs. Boaz answers to her and said, all you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told to me, and how you left your mother and your father and your native land and you came to the people that you did not know before. And then he prays for her here. The Lord repay you for what you have done and give you a full reward be given you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wing you have come to take refuge. Then she responds back to him and says, oh, I found favor in your eyes. Even though I'm not one of your servants, you have talked to me. Even though I'm lower than your servant, you have spoken kind words to me. Let me set this scene up for you. We're getting to mealtime here. We're getting to the first interaction. But let me give you some examples here of what Ruth has done. Ruth has followed and worked hard and listened to Naomi. She has come into the field. She has asked permission. She has been kind and gentle. She has bowed down. She has done everything appropriately to set herself up as a Proverbs 31 woman. Boaz has come into this field. Boaz has noticed her. Boaz has then said, you work in my fields. I'm going to provide for you. I've told my guys not to touch you. I'm going to protect you. He continues that on here in just a few minutes. And then he prays for her. Guys, if you want to be a guy like Boaz, you need to set yourself up to be a provider, a protector, and to pray for those who you have interest in. Ladies, Proverbs 31 woman. So mealtime comes, and Boaz says, let's go on a group date. Let's get to know each other a little bit. Not some casual thing, but in a group setting. Come over here and dip your bread and your morsel into this, into my wine. So she sat down beside the reapers, and Boaz, he passed her the roasted grain. Boaz served her at this point. She was satisfied and had some left over. And then Boaz says to the young men, let her glean even among the sheaves, and do not reproach her. Pull out some bundles from it, leave it for her, do not rebuke her. So she gleaned until the evening. Boaz says to his boys this, if you touch her, I've got a big gun, and this is a big field, and they'll never find you. Get careless hands. When you pull some of this out, you leave it for her. And so the picture we get there is Ruth walking behind, gleaning that afternoon, and they drop just a huge amount, and she looks, and she goes, wait, wait, sir, you've dropped some here. You've dropped it. And then they look back at her, and they go, oh, no, that's yours. Boaz told us to. Oh, and Ruth, can you see her in that field? Boaz, he told you to drop this for me? Boaz, the guy that prayed for me already and is protecting me, Boaz? Oh, Boaz. Can you see the wheels turning? And so she goes back and she tells her mother-in-law all that happens. Now when she gets there and sees the mother-in-law and she's got all of this barley in her hands, I can imagine her mother-in-law looked and thought, oh no, what has Ruth done? Doesn't she understand gleaning doesn't work this way? You don't get this much gleaning. She's not been gleaning. She's got all of her hands full. She's got 30 to 50 pounds of barley. We're going to jail. They're going to run us out of town. Hey, Ruth, come here. Who in the world took, what have you been doing? How did you get this? Oh, and then Ruth sat down and told her the story. Oh, but I found favor. I went and they took great care of me. Oh, and the guy whose field I worked in, what was his name? I remember. His name was Boaz. Naomi says, who? Boaz. Oh, now Naomi's wheels start turning. He says, blessed be the Lord, by whose loving kindness, by whose hesed, has not forsaken the living or the dead. Naomi said to her, this man is a Goel. This man is a redeemer. He is a close relative of ours. He is one of our kinsmen redeemers. Naomi says, all right, you need to stay close to that field. You don't need to go anywhere else. Boaz has already said that you can stay there. You can glean for the next 7 weeks through the barley and the wheat harvest. You stay right there. Naomi's wheels start turning. A redeemer. Perhaps this means that there's a wedding coming up in the future. But 7 weeks have now passed at the end of chapter 2. The barley and the wheat harvest has passed, and it says, and she lived with her mother-in-law. So now it comes time for action. Here in verse 3, Naomi, the mother-in-law, said to her, my daughter, should I not seek rest for you that it may be well for you? Is Boaz not our relative? He's going to be down winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. Here's my advice to you. I don't think Boaz understands that you are available. Now, girls, I don't take this that she's pursuing Boaz. I take this as she's getting in Boaz's way. I take this as she's letting Boaz know, I'm available. She's not on the pursuit. Boaz has already been the one pursuing. Boaz has been the one providing. He's been the one protecting. He's been the one taking the initiative. And now what happens is Naomi says to Ruth, it's time for the DTR. You need to have the define the relationship. You need to change your Facebook status to not in a relationship, to unsure, pending, or whatever the other one says. Mine says married. I don't know what the other options are. You need to go find out what's going on. But now listen to what she says here. She gives good instruction that we all need to take heed of. It says in verse 3, wash. It's pretty obvious, right? But think about it. Ruth's been in a field. She's been working. Has Boaz ever seen Ruth clean and washed and ready to go? No. Wash. Take off those garments. Anoint yourself. Take off your widow garments. Put on some normal clothes. Now, we can't make too much out of this and say she's telling her to get all dolled up or anything. But what she is telling her is make yourself presentable and anoint yourself. Go down there. And when you go down there, does she say go down there to him and make yourself obnoxious in front of all of his friends? No, ladies, don't do that. Don't ever call for a DTR in front of all the guy's friends. Don't ever call him out and say, why don't you stand up and do something in front of him? If you do, then it's over. I mean, it's a done deal at that point. you might as well be signing the papers that you don't ever want to talk to him again. She says to him, when you go down there, you just wait until he's finished eating and drinking. You wait until he's watched North Carolina win the national basketball championship, eating wings and drinking an ice-cold Diet Coke in his recliner. And when he's all fat and happy, then you go talk to him. Okay, that's not quite what it says, but it's something close to that. It says to him, after he lies down, go and uncover his feet. You can ask your Hebrew professors about all that later. I don't have time to go into it. It's a little weird. But it says, go and uncover his feet, lie down. Now, there's nothing sexual going on here. I'll prove that to you in just a minute. But he says, go and lie down, and he'll tell you what you should do. So she does exactly what Naomi has told her. She takes counsel from an older woman, which is the Titus 2 model, and she says, I'm going to take this counsel and go do what I should. And so she goes down, and while she's there, Boaz had eaten his wings and had drunk his Diet Coke, and his heart was merry because North Carolina had won. I'm just kidding. I like North Carolina if you don't know that. He went and lied down at the end of the heap of grain, and then she came softly and uncovered his feet. At midnight, the man was startled. You get the image here. His feet are uncovered. A cool breeze blows through. That cool breeze hits those toes, and all of a sudden, he jerks up a little bit, and he looks down, and he sees his toes. Now, if that's not enough, just beyond his toes, he sees some hair, and he sees the figure of a lady, and he says to himself, who are you? What are you doing here? What's going on? Notice what the response is. You'll see it there in verse 9. I am Ruth, your servant. Spread your wings over your servant, for you are a redeemer. Now, why is that important? If you skip back up to chapter 2, verse 12, you remember when Boaz responded. Boaz said, may the reward be given you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. She responds by indicating and reminding him back to that first meeting. She says, spread your wings. I came to Israel to take refuge under the God of Israel's wings. Now I'm coming to you to take refuge under your wings. She's saying to him, Boaz, I'm interested. Might not be a bad idea if you get a move on. We've had a DTR. Let's see what the response is. He responds, this is how I know nothing sexual takes place here. May you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. You don't pray for somebody when you're about to take advantage of them. Now, guys, if you're single and you're on this campus and you're trying to take advantage of our girls, I'll probably see you in my office sooner or later, and I have a big field, and they won't find you. Here we see a prayer that takes place. May the Lord bless you, my daughter. All right, now it's a little weird he's calling her his daughter when we know this is a love story. But his intentions here are seen. He understands, and he goes on to say that you have shown great loving kindness, great hesed kindness, greater than the first when you have not gone after young men, whether rich or poor. And now, my daughter, do not fear for what you ask. And I will tell all the townsmen because they know you are a worthy woman. And now it is true that I am a redeemer. She's a worthy woman. In chapter 2, verse 1, he's described as a worthy man. He prays for her. He's concerned about her. He calls her his daughter. Those who want to make something inappropriate out of this relationship are not reading the text plainly for what it says. There is nothing going on that's wrong here in this text. But Boaz is a better man than most of us. Because look at what he says next. Yet, there is a redeemer nearer than I. All right, now let's be honest with yourselves. If you were to have a younger woman come up to you, and we know she's a younger woman because he keeps calling her his daughter and because he says you have not gone after young men, whether poor or rich. If you had a younger woman come up to you and say to yourself, I want you to be my redeemer, and there was some other guy in the way, and we lived in the time of the judges when everybody did what was right in their own eyes, wouldn't you find a way to get around that? Oh, there's some other guy. We just won't tell him anything about this. I really like this girl. I don't care if my best friend has interest in her too. I'm not going to approach this in a godly way. I'm going to approach this selfishly for myself. And instead, Boaz says, no. Yeah, I have interest, but there's one closer. I've got to go and I've got to tell him. I've got to do what's right. And so you remain tonight. Because it's dark outside, it's late. I don't want you to get hurt tonight. You remain here tonight. And then he wakes up early in the morning, though. Notice what happens there at the end of verse 14. He gets up and he says, let it not be known that the woman came to the threshing floor. He's worried about her reputation. Guys, if you're courting somebody, by the way, dating is something you do just for fun. Courting is when you're looking for a mate, when you're looking for a legacy, when you're looking for a spouse. If you're dating just for fun, that's not biblical. We can talk about that another time. If you're courting, you're out looking for the relationship and the reputation of the person you're with. Are you concerned about the reputation of that person you're hanging out and spending time with? Do you want to talk them into staying an extra 3 hours over at your apartment just because you're not in seminary housing? So that they come back home to the dorm room 3 hours late and everybody sees it. Are you worried about the reputation of the person so that they're not going to be blasphemed or they're not going to hurt the gospel of Jesus Christ? Are you worried about the fact that maybe you shouldn't be seen alone in certain locations? Maybe you shouldn't be alone in certain locations because it would lead other people to think things are happening that are not and should not happen. Are you concerned about the reputation? Are you treating that girl or that guy as though they're a brother and sister in Christ instead of a trophy to be placed on a wall? What we see here is a guy who's concerned about safety, but he's also concerned about reputation. He's also smart. What he does here is he gives her 6 measures of barley, and when Ruth gets back to the mother-in-law, we find out that he said, "You must not go empty-handed to your mother-in-law." Guys, I'll tell you this much. You can date the woman, court the woman, win the woman, and never give any time to the mother-in-law, and you might get her, but it won't be happily ever after. If you want a happily ever after, be wise. Send the mother-in-law flowers too. Get the mother-in-law to like you too. My mother-in-law loves me, and it's great. I love it. I love my mother-in-law. We don't have any problems. It's just marvelous. Don't think that you're not going to have to spend the rest of your life with a mother-in-law. Now, if you don't like your mother-in-law and you're preaching this, you can insert mother-in-law jokes here. For me, I love my mother-in-law, and so I'm not going to do that. It says here, though, look at what she says to Ruth. "Wait, my daughter, until you learn how the matter turns out, for the man will not rest, but he will settle the matter today." Maybe you're sitting here, maybe you've already had the DTR and you've been waiting on this guy to take some action. He hasn't taken any action. You're wondering what in the world's going on. Take the advice of Naomi to Ruth. Wait. If this guy will not close the deal, if this guy will not go take care of business, you don't want him anyway because he's a loser. He's a bozo, not a Boaz. If he's not going to close the deal and lead in a relationship of dating or courtship, how in the world is he ever going to lead you spiritually in a marriage? How in the world is he going to provide and protect and lead like he's supposed to if he's not willing to take the lead here and now? And so Naomi says, wait. Now, does Boaz waste any time? Well, in chapter 4, we'll see Boaz's faithfulness. Boaz had gone up to the gate and sat down there. And he said to the Redeemer of whom Boaz had spoken who came by, Boaz said to him, "Turn aside, my friend. Come here." They don't give us his name. They call him Mr. So-and-so. "Come here, Mr. So-and-so. We got to talk. I've got 10 elders of the city. I'm here ready to do business. We're going to get this deal done. I'm going to close this deal. I've got somewhere to be. Come here and let's talk." He's a shrewd businessman too. I don't have time to point all that out, but he's a shrewd businessman. He says, "There's a deal taking place. Naomi's back in town. She's got to sell the field. Will, you are the closest redeemer. Do you want to redeem it?" Well, this guy thinks about this, and he says, "Sure, why not? Naomi has no offspring. I can redeem the field, up my standing in the community. She dies, I get the field back. It's a win-win for me. I will redeem it." But then Boaz pulls out his ace up his sleeve. He says, "Wait a second, Ruth, you know the Moabite." Now, does he say this to degrade her? Probably not, but maybe to close the deal. "Ruth, the Moabite, you remember her. She comes along with the deal. And you've got to continue her lineage if you want to redeem her." Well, at this point, this guy says, "No, I can't do that. I will relinquish my right. You can have my right and redeem her." So they trade shoes. Maybe one had Nike, another Adidas. I'm not sure what was taking place there. But it was the custom of the day that when they walked, they would trade shoes. So they trade shoes to seal the deal. And then at this point, you see the witnesses understanding what has happened and testifying. In fact, you'll see in verse 11 of chapter 4, it says, "We are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming to your house like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel." You understand Rachel and Leah, the 12 tribes of Israel. They're praying a blessing hereupon. And so in verse 13, you see this. It says, "So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife." We're not given an exact time frame, but I can tell you this. They weren't engaged for 2 years and never set a date for the wedding. I don't understand people that are engaged over long periods of time. I can't point to a verse in the Scripture, but I'll tell you out of my personal recommendation, long engagements are absolutely crazy. You're either a better man than I am, or you're already committing sin, and you don't need to get married. If you know this is the person that God wants you to have, short engagement, get married, and let's move on. I could go on. I better stop. Actually, I probably won't. Let me tell you a little quick story. How I met my wife. She's here. She's going to get in trouble. All right, how I met my wife. What's the first thing I noticed about my wife? The first thing I noticed about my wife was in chapel at Southeastern Seminary. She had gone out witnessing on Friday night with a student witnessing group called Doulos, with the president of the group and with Dr. Patterson. Now, right off the bat, I thought anybody brave enough to go witnessing as a student with Dr. Patterson has got some credentials in my book. So I'm sitting out there about over in this section here, and I look up, and when I see her, I don't remember a word she said, by the way. I just remember thinking, well done, God. And then I remember thinking, and she witnesses. I didn't know they made that package together. The first thing I noticed was witnessing. The first thing I understood is that she was a godly woman, and that's what's more important than looks. If all you're out here after is somebody that looks good, you're going to have a good-looking wife that can't teach your kids how to go to heaven and lead your family straight to hell. The first thing that attracted me to her was her actions, and then after that, we hung out in groups. I thought to myself, okay, where does she go to church? I found out, suddenly I felt the call of God to visit that church. I found out she had a washing machine that needed fixing. I suddenly felt the call of God to become a repairman. It worked for two loads, but it accomplished the purpose, mission done. I mean, relationship, it started. We went out to a church. We went door-to-door witnessing together, and sure enough, she knew how to witness. It was great, and then she went to hear me speak, and then came the DTR. She said, I don't date casually. Haven't dated casually for 4 years. Don't date casually. I don't do it. What are your intentions? Well, I didn't want to give my intentions out, so I just changed the subject and moved on to a different topic of conversation. Later that day, what are your intentions? Later that night, what are your intentions? Okay, I got to tell her. All right, I know what my intentions are, but I got to vocalize it. You don't want to know what my intentions are, I told her. Yes, I do. I have to know. I'm going to marry you. By the way, I don't recommend that. That's usually what stalkers do and crazy people, but that's what I said. I said, I'm going to marry you. She said, God hasn't told me that yet. I said, don't worry, he will. 3 months later, God did tell her that. And so now to this day, I'm 3 months closer to the Lord than my wife. But we'll move on real quickly. I'm just kidding. But I do use that anytime we get in a discussion. She became Boaz's wife. He went into her, and what happened? The Lord gave her conception, and she bore a son. She had been married for almost 10 years to Mahlon. Nothing happened. The Lord didn't bless. She had been married to Boaz, apparently one night, and the Lord blesses that union. You can see how it goes on here. I'm out of time. I've got to move on. I need to draw a few conclusions for you. How can we take and apply this? I would say to you, in way of application, that no matter how bad the times are, God is still sovereign, in control, providential, working and moving. In the time of the judges, when they did what was right in their own eyes, God was paving the way for King David. God was paving the way for the lineage of Christ. Even in the worst of times, take heart that God is still at work, even in the midst of your finals. The second thing I would tell you here is that human wisdom equals destruction. That's the first five verses. Divine wisdom equals a legacy. That's the rest of the book. Thirdly, I would tell you that Ruth's story is our story. If you look down at verse 21, it says, and Salmon fathered Boaz. If you were to turn over to Matthew, you would see that Salmon fathered Boaz by Rahab the harlot. Why is it that Boaz took notice of Ruth? Somewhere in the lineage, you have Rahab the harlot. Perhaps as a mother, some debate that. But somewhere in the lineage, he understood that people can be ostracized and that that's not right. He understood that God can love Gentiles. He understood that what the law excludes, grace includes. He understood, and he offered favor to Ruth. Ruth's story is our story. Just like Ruth, I used to live in Moab. I used to be on the wrong side of the law. I used to be in a place where I couldn't get to God. But as Boaz was that light kinsman, Jesus Christ, it tells us in the New Testament, came down and became one of us and took on the likeness of a human and became in the incarnation one of our kinsmen redeemers. Boaz was able. He had the money. Jesus was able. He lived a perfect life, sinless and spotless, the lamb to be sacrificed and slain on the cross. Boaz was willing. Jesus said, no man takes my life, but I lay it down. Jesus was willing. Just as Boaz is the kinsman redeemer in the Old Testament, Jesus Christ is the ultimate Boaz. He is the kinsman redeemer for you and for me. Just as Ruth was ostracized and sinful and not perfect, neither were we, excluded by the law but included by grace. And that is the story of redemption. Redemption is not some legal transaction that takes place. Redemption is the greatest love story ever told, and it's our job to make sure we go and tell it. Ruth's story is our story. Let us go to the Lord in prayer. Dear Lord, I pray that our men would be like Boaz. I pray that our women would be like Ruth. I pray that our children would be a spiritual legacy. And I pray that our story of redemption would be told to every person with whom we come in contact. And we ask this in the name of the ultimate Boaz, Jesus Christ, our kinsman redeemer. Amen.